Hey, I'm Zach.
And I'm Ben.
And welcome to the Movie Vault. Today we are going to review A Man Escaped, spoiler alert, in the title. Well, Ben, what year did this movie come out?
This movie came out
in 1956, which is super old.
I was going between 58 and 56.
Yeah.
Because I forgot to pull up the Wikipedia article.
No, you're good.
Beforehand.
No, I was just quizzing you. And it is obviously a very, very well-known film, as when I watched through this, I saw so many other movies within it. But it is directed by Robert Bresson. Is that how you say it?
Bresson.
Bresson. Oh, okay.
Robert Bresson. He's French. So. Yeah.
And you are a resident French expert.
Not really, but the key with French is you like don't pronounce things. It's kind of like Jean-Luc Godard, or like it's like the least amount of pronunciation possible.
Okay, so
I think
forget consonants.
Like au revoir les enfants.
Pretty much. Okay. Yeah.
So like in English it looks like au revoir les enfantes, but in French it's au revoir les enfants.
Okay. So well, Robert Bresson, yeah. Since you've been to Europe, you know so much. Huh?
Yeah. I'm so smart in this department.
Yes, it is based on a memoir by André Devigny. Is that how you say that, Ben?
Probably not, but okay. I didn't do that much
research
into that.
It is about an hour and 40 minutes, and it's really just a prison break movie. And basically, it's just a very quick plot. There's this guy who was in the French Resistance, who ends up going to a prison. It's called Montluc. I forget how that's pronounced. And the German captors kind of have him in this cell, and they lock him up. But he tries to escape before that, while this train is passing by, and he tries to escape out the car. They get him back in the car, and he comes in on the first floor of the Montluc, and he immediately tries to figure out ways to escape. And then once he starts talking with the people through, he communicates to them by knocking on the walls and stuff like that. He gets moved up a couple floors to a place where he doesn't have to wear handcuffs. So then he is able to kind of freely move around in his cell, figuring out different ways to escape, such as, moving the panels in a door on for his cell, putting together, threading different ropes from clothing and mattress, stuff like that, springs, and then making hooks as well from the lantern in his room. So there are lots of different intuitive different things that he does, and it's great. And he has a neighbor, Blanchett, who is kind of this old guy who doesn't really want to escape because he's kind of scared, but he's glad that that Fontaine, the main character, is able to kind of find a way to escape. And then there is also like these other people that he gets to meet while he's washing his hair all throughout the film. And there are some great banter, but the guards keep telling them, stop talking, it's every day with you two. And it's they start to think that maybe he's able to escape. And then, he meets another guy who is able to kind of like be the dummy for him to figure out ways to escape. So he meets Fontaine. His name's Orsini. I forget how they pronounce it, but that's how I'm going to pronounce it. And he doesn't think that Fontaine's plan is going to work, so he goes and he tries to escape kind of more abruptly, and they catch him, they execute him, but before that they say he gets to tell Fontaine, use hooks. So he gets hooks and he fashions them together. But before Fontaine is able to do it, he actually gets kind of nervous and kind of like prolongs the inevitable, and then he gets a roommate after he gets his death sentence for his case had been finalized. And his roommate is named Jost, and he is a younger guy, soldier, who at first he's very skeptical of. He thinks he's a German spy. After that, he learns to trust him, and they escape. And there's this long, 15-minute sequence of them trying to escape in silence, waiting for the train to pass by for them to make their move, and they do it plenty of times. And then in the last shot, they actually get to escape undetected by the guards, and the Germans never find them, supposedly. And they kind of shift into the fog as they walk away from the prison. So that's pretty much the plot of it. What were your expectations going into this?
I think I'd heard really good things about Robert Bresson. I think I first heard him from the YouTuber Carsten Rundquist, who's kind of your classic film school YouTuber, I guess you could say. So somebody who watches some mainstream movies, covers those, but also will reference back to like older movies. And I would see this on like Criterion stuff too. There was another movie I think called Pickpocket that's also pretty well known that maybe was filmed. I'm not sure whether it was filmed before or after, but in a very similar time frame to this film. But I was curious about Brisson's style because I knew it was very like direct, to the point, minimalist, but still potentially very profound. And I think I was pretty satisfied in what I saw.
Yeah, same here. I just actually finished this. When did you watch it? How many days ago?
It's actually been, I think, 5 days ago, or 6 days ago when I finished it.
Good. We're getting two different perspectives of it, an aged and a kind of coming out of the theater reaction. Yeah,
kind
of
aged like the bourbon that we're drinking.
Yeah, for sure. But, well, not 4 years. But, no, this movie, speaking of age, has not, because it has lived the test of time. Because
true.
It has influenced so many different things. The most notable being, what would you think it is?
Well, I know you had mentioned Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, Shawshank Redemption, for sure. The number one movie on Rotten Tomatoes for, like, what, over 10 years?
Yeah.
It was influenced by this film, and you see so many different things. You know, this pursuit of freedom by a guy who is unjustly caged, and it's, you kind of have this friend that is there to kind of let him out. And I never mentioned that there was another guy that gets to walk around the courtyard freely who gave him the tools to even start out with.
Right.
That was something I missed, but... yeah, so like it's not just him. It's all these different people. Social cooperation is occurring. And what other things do you think it's influenced?
Well, I've seen that it's influenced Christopher Nolan.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How?
Which I think Christopher Nolan just says he really likes Brisson. Let's see where the exact quote was. Oh, Dunkirk was influenced by this movie. It's this movie and Pickpocket influenced Dunkirk. Okay. I think maybe... you have to think a little bit less directly related to the plot and more to the fact that Dunkirk is like very focused and kind of minimalist in a sense.
Okay.
Like it's a war movie, but it focuses on sort of a singular events as opposed to like a broader picture of the war.
Yeah.
So I think that's the way I would, and maybe, you know, no one likes to play with time. I would say that Brisson is pretty linear in his view of time in his movies. Cause it's like, just something starts and then it sees it to the completion.
Yeah.
And it's and in the English titles, I mean, the French title for this movie is like A Man Condemned to Death That Has Escaped or The Wind Blows Where It Wants, which is a quote from John 3:8 actually.
Yeah, the Gospel of John.
In English you see A Man Escaped and it's about a man who escaped. So I think maybe sort of the minimalism influences it. It also influenced Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieslowski, who made the Colors trilogy.
Oh, really?
Which you may have heard
of.
And then Benny Safdie is a big fan of this film.
Oh.
So I don't know their influence. I mean,
he's
or
just
how
a
much.
Fan.
Yeah, he's just
but
a fan.
But we love Benny Safdie, as he was in the latest Nolan, right?
Yes, he was in the latest
Nolan. But yeah. And by the way, the Pickpocket came out 3 years after this. So they are pretty. It's right after
right.
He Made a Man Escaped. But, yeah, it was definitely an interesting film. It kind of keeps you on the edge of your seat. An interesting thing, though, Ben, that I learned is the main character is... it's like something... Leterrier is his last name. I'm just going to call him that. Leterrier. I don't know. However you do it. That was more Italian. But he was actually a philosophy student. And he went into like some kind of film club at the University of Paris... and he was involved in that for a while. And then he went to Morocco for military service. And then Robert Brisson met him there, and he kind of casted him because he's known for, like, getting these people that don't really they don't have a name anything like
that. I have heard this about Brisson, that he casts a lot of non-actors in his roles.
Yeah.
Which
now,
I'm curious
all of his
to
films.
Know why.
I don't know. I think it brings a freshness to it, and it kind of, like, I don't know. When I think of, I mean... you got to think about it. Like, the biggest case right now is RDJ, where he can't get his name unattached from Iron Man. But then movies like Oppenheimer kind of help him out in that way. But in this, it's more like he kind of knew back in 1956 that a fresh face would be a great thing. But anyway, he got him in, and he was able to kind of work with a bunch of other famous people known for helping people act, method acting, stuff like that. But he ended up... that, like, started his career, and he ended up taking that further and doing other films. So he did much more than that. But he did, his son, actually, Francois' son, his name's Louis, Louis, or whatever you'd say for that. But he ended up doing, he was in the movie Transporter in The Incredible Hulk, Clash of Titans, and Now You See Me. It's just a weird thing. That's the son of the main guy in this.
Huh.
So that's just an interesting thing. It's kind of more of Bresson's style when it comes to this. But what would you say? What would you further say about his style?
It's very simple and stripped back from anything. There's one of the notable things is that there's very minimal use of music. I think that music is used, but it's just used very sparsely.
Yeah.
Throughout the film, and he does use narration, so it's kind of like a. Is it first person narration? It is, right? So first person narration is used. So you're getting into the mind of the person escaping, and then there is dialogue, but it's like pretty much just dialogue that is necessary. It's also due to the setting, right? So they're in a prison. They can't say much more than they need to say. Although there's a bit of banter and when they're like in common areas every once in a while. But generally, it's a look at a specific task that's being accomplished and the complications of it, and maybe just like exploring things that you wouldn't think of, like how do you hide when you're chipping away at a door, very like tedious, like things that you would think would not be that interesting.
Yeah,
but Bresson pulls those out and makes them interesting.
It's almost like an honesty in this. There's like this truthfulness in it because it's based on a memoir. So it's almost like he pulled these straight I statements, first person statements from that
and
pushed it into this film. I thought something that was interesting was hands. There were a lot of shots about hands in this film. And it's cool to see like all these actions that are being performed are just shots of his hands. They never showed the Leterrier in any of the action shots. It was mainly just his hands, and they like enlarged them and did a zoom in, like him putting together like rope and twine and putting together the sheets and the clothing,
or like the part where he like picks the lock on his handcuffs and like that. Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of hand shots.
I wonder what is the deeper meaning in that.
I don't know whether is there deeper meaning, or is it just we're trying to show with unadulterated focus the actions, like, because almost like even seeing him would distract you from what's actually happening.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly it, actually. But I think that's not nothing, because it's like the title is A Man Escaped. I think of it's a man who escaped, so it's him. It's not these circumstances. It's not anything else. It's like him doing and performing actions to actually get this thing done. And him escaping involves using his hands and getting dirty, kind of, and like performing these tasks. That's such a straightforward thing to say, but you could watch a film where it talks about, you know, there's an action and a noun in the title, and it talks, you know, it could be a full sentence, you know, a man escaped is a full sentence, but then you have all these different shots of showing like so many different things, and it's more like the circumstances are taking place, but what's taking place in this film is just him. And it's what his interactions are. There is not a scene where he's not in it, right?
Yeah.
So it's all about him. And really, I think it's about his hands. It's about the action that he performs. And it stays so focused on that. And it makes it good.
And from the very start of the film to the end, there's never any questioning that he's going to try to escape. He immediately tries to escape. As soon as the film starts, it doesn't work.
Yes.
He gets beat up. Yeah, I think he has bloodstains on his
the clothes whole time
for the rest of the film because of the start where he tries to jump out of the car and then they catch him and they beat him, and he has to like promise that he's not going to escape, which is just like a formality because they know that he's going to try and he knows that he's going to try, but he has to play the part that he's not going to.
But
they take all these precautions, and he's so singly focused on this task of escaping, and he almost never like other people question whether he should try to escape, but he never does. And he talks about like seeing his family again, or like asking people like if you could see your family again. And so it's like that doesn't just happen without actions that lead to the end result.
It's a memoir, but it doesn't really go into the implications of how he feels. And I think that's great. I think it's more of like a. I feel like I'm reading a children's book that's telling me what nouns and adjectives and verbs are, where it's like it's just showing the simplest skeleton form of the story, and it's such a beautiful thing because so many things happen. Roger Ebert said that there isn't a scene that isn't necessary. And it's crazy.
True.
And I thought of that after watching it. And I was like, Yeah, I can't really think of one. So then it was more of a looking back and like, you can describe in every single scene, this is him escaping. There is no delineation from that. There's nothing, you know, no tangent or anything.
And they could go on so many tangents because it's set in World War II. They're in a Nazi prison camp. Like, so many other films about this would divert into like, oh, we got to do a second story arc. We got to create some backstory for these characters, which some of them get backstory a little bit, but it's like as much as you need. No more. Kind of like what Roger Ebert said. So any wavering from the singular focus that Bresson had could have hurt the film, but because he was so dedicated to doing what he wanted to do with it, like, it resulted in the 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes that it eventually got whenever Rotten Tomatoes was started.
Yeah.
And, you know, him winning Best Director at Cannes and all that.
And it's interesting that you said, so the focus also excluded many musical, you know, score facets of the film. But the only things that were played were by Mozart. Did you know that?
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that it was like music by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
It was interesting. I was like,
do you think it was a choice that they picked a German composer to play?
Oh, man. I'm not going to lie. I didn't know he was German. I'm pretty sure Mozart
is German.
Okay, interesting.
But I don't know what the Nazi relation. I mean, obviously he would have been dead by that time, long dead.
Yeah.
By the time Nazi Germany came around,
you never know. He could be on the moon.
But I mean, it's possible that he would have been somebody that the Nazis co-opted in showing why German culture was amazing.
Yeah.
And that he could have picked a French composer, but he didn't. And maybe the Germans are known for a rich musical history, but
I don't know. I feel like Bresson's honesty in this film, I'm gonna keep using that term as I've described it, is sort of like an homage to Andre da Vinci, whatever, the memoir author, because this is exactly kind of what he went through. You know, he was imprisoned in World War II in France. The Gestapo was like coming after him, and they were kind of ruthless at that time. And he was in the French Resistance, so it's kind of like a bad scenario for him. And he's writing this memoir during that, and he's probably including like painful things in it, right? Don't you think?
Do you think he's
putting his emotions in there?
Oh yeah.
Do you think he's putting like, I felt terrible and I had to just sit down for a minute, or I miss my family, something like that? I'm just assuming. I've never read it. I have no idea.
I would think that maybe there would be a little bit more like, personal touch to a memoir, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah. So it's but people have described it as actually very similar to his memoir. I'm not ever going to read it probably. But Bresson is more, I think he did this because he wanted to. This came out 13 years after the events, right? So it's like pretty soon after the World War II.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing to think about. This is not that far after World War II.
Yeah, and Bresson needed to stay not neutral, but almost like to show like a good side of this guy so that he can actually have his story told in some real authentic way. What it was like being imprisoned by Germans. There are probably so many worse stories than what happened in this film.
And I'm sure it was helpful that he was a French prisoner of war, not Jewish or not in Germany, or, you know, there's a lot of things that could have benefited him in this case, but he's nonetheless in prison.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. So I'm guessing, since it is so fresh on America's mind and in the world's mind, honestly, definitely, that if he chose a worse scenario than this, a non-French prisoner, I wonder what direction he would take in that. But I'm curious, because I think he picked this for a reason, because he wanted to keep it not mild, but keep it as in like, this isn't gonna piss off a whole country.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Because
he was well known by then.
Yeah.
So movies like that would go around the world and they would be known. Right. So I'm just wondering what that looked like back then. But I don't know. I mean, we don't really know.
I mean, I imagine at this point, I mean, there was movies, like if you think about Casablanca, movies were already being made about World War II while it was happening. So I can imagine by this point there had been tons of movies about World War II, but I'm not exactly sure what the tenderness was and the national politics of all of this. But yeah, there certainly is probably a reason. I noticed he said that he wanted to achieve a great purity and a great, I don't even know this word, ascetism, a greater ascetism. I need to look up that word because I honestly don't even know what that means. And then he references a book or a movie that I've never heard of.
Hmm. Yeah. No.
Severe self-discipline and avoidance of all forms of indulgence. So, let me hear that pronounced.
And you. No, I'm just joking. I think, yeah, that's definitely true. And I don't really know because I wasn't there. And when I was researching, I couldn't really find anything about why he picked this particular scenario. Probably because there's a memoir that's pretty well known that's already out there. Kind of like why people make Anne Frank movies. But
yeah,
the sounds in this film, pretty silent. So I'm wondering if he was trying to capture that aspect of kind of this contained, this man is contained in the cell. The only way that he can actually peer outside of the cell is through using his senses. And it's almost like what he hears is silence, so we hear silence. What he sees is what we see. You know, yeah. What he's doing, that's part of the hands as well, what he's doing.
Yeah. And feeling. And every noise feels a little louder because you know he's in the cell and he's trying to keep quiet and you're like, is he making too much noise?
That's very true.
And then there's like a point where, I don't know, he's watching the guards and there's like this like loud whistle or something that would go on and it sounded so abrasive because it was just that and then silence. And yeah. He didn't even know what the sound was at first.
Yeah, and even at the end when they were trying to escape, he said, yeah, there's this sound, this like ringing, this whistling that I can't figure out what it is. I actually don't know if they did. Maybe they did, but I didn't see that why. But then the train was obviously the big one. Kind of you have this, you have it at the beginning of the film and at the end where the train is the thing that kind of allows him to escape, whether it works or not. So at the end it does work, gratefully, but at the beginning he still gets captured back. But it's very like understated to say that like the silence isn't a big part of the silence is a big part of this film because I think the silence is trying to convey like what the memoir was about, just kind of this like isolated person in a room who only really gets to talk with people. Like most of the dialogue takes place after Jost comes back into the cell with him
when he has to talk.
Yeah, and as soon as he, like, he just becomes obsessed with this plan to escape, as he would, because he hates the silence. He talked about it at one point. The only thing that he could do was just like shrivel his gaze or something like that. Like he couldn't, he just looked around, you know, and he's just trying to figure out ways to escape. And that's the only thing that his mind will think. So with that singular focus in this film, does that add much more than other films that have kind of tried to emulate this? Like, does this live up to or past Shawshank Redemption?
This is like trying to compare two different things, so it's a little bit difficult. But I think the thing is, Shawshank Redemption is Hollywood's version of a Robert Bresson movie because there's a lot of drama. It's almost, I wouldn't say it's an anthology, but because of the time gaps and stuff, it's like a little bit more segmented, and it builds up to a much more emotional ending. And it's very like cinematic. I hate using the word cinematic because it seems, anyway. But it's cinematic. You know what I'm saying? It's cinematic in the sense that like at the ending, it's like you get this big rush of like adrenaline almost from satisfaction because of how much work that this guy has done. But a lot of the actual action of escaping, not to spoil, well, I guess a little bit of spoilers for Shawshank Redemption, but a lot of the action of escaping is off camera in Shawshank Redemption. And it goes more into detail about other characters in the movie. There's even a point where they have a separate section specifically about one of the side characters. So it definitely doesn't use the same level of restraint as A Man Escaped, but it's not trying to, right? It's taking what Robert Bresson, the foundation that he laid of a prison escape, and then turning it into a story about someone's life.
Yeah, and maybe a comparison is not valid, but I'm wondering on the basis of, does the noise help?
Does the noise, and
I'm saying that this film was very, very silent, and I'm saying, does the noise, and I use the noise as a larger term of side quests, everything that can fall into that as well.
Does it help?
Does
it make it better? I personally would say no.
Okay.
But that's my personal opinion. Somebody might watch this movie and find it far too tedious and not as emotionally rewarding as Shawshank Redemption. But I think when I watch this, I can respect the purity of story and almost feel like I'm watching the reality of what it would be like to escape it. To escape a prison, whereas I know the Shawshank Redemption would never happen because it's like so dramatized.
Yeah, and Morgan Freeman's there, but I also think like the Shawshank and A Man Escaped are very, very different movies with different themes, different directors, and different goals that they have.
Yeah,
that's very true, and they both achieve their goals pretty well.
Yeah, I would say they both achieve their goals.
But
pretty well.
I think what is lost in Shawshank is the ability to feel what another man is feeling when he is imprisoned.
True.
Because throughout this whole film, it's kind of like there is this despair in the background that everyone has. The pastor, yeah. The crazy guy, the Fontaine, Jost, everybody has this despair, whether it sets in later in the film or at the beginning, or they already had it. Even the neighbor. So, and it shows like the only thing that they have is this plan, right? That's the only thing that Fontaine has. He has nothing else. That's why he's so focused, and the film doesn't play anything else but that. And then as the film goes on, like, it's just the most, you know, natural, you know, primitive concerns that they have. Can I trust another person? Can I get food and water for the next time? That's not explicitly stated.
Am I willing to kill an innocent person so that I can escape? That is a question that happens,
yeah.
That he asks himself towards the end of the movie.
There is no layering in this. It's just simple. It's very much just there. And people don't realize, like, if you were in that situation, it becomes much simpler of a choice. It's a hard choice, but it becomes much simpler of a choice.
Everything becomes more binary.
Yeah.
It's either you do this or you do this. And it's like, you either do this and escape, or you don't do this and you won't be able to escape.
Yeah.
And then somebody else has a decision, and whether they make that decision or not gives them two options.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it definitely reduces complication.
Yeah, for sure. Like at the end, when he's questioning whether or not Jost is a, you know, like a Nazi traitor, it's kind of interesting to be like, yes, this is exactly what would happen. That's what I would think in that situation, because I've prolonged escaping so long that it's like I'm waiting for this thing to happen, and this is the only thing that's getting in my way. Like my linear direction, my very tunnel vision mind, one thing is getting in that way, and my whole world is like abruptly shaken. Even when he was going out to get his death sentence, he's like, will I go back to the same cell? That's months and months of work gone.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, like a shiv protects you. That, like a shiv in jail is your life. You're holding onto an object that is your life. It's just much more simpler, whereas in the real world, it's much more complex. You know, you can get into stocks and bonds and like life insurance and stuff like that. These theoretical things that people uphold by social contract. But in this film, it's really primitive. It's just like, will I live or will I die based on these decisions that I make?
Yeah, and I guess he gets, in some ways, the theoretical noose on his life gets tighter and tighter because he is actually faced with, he's going to die. I guess there's some ambiguity at the start of the movie as to whether he'll actually get charged or not. And like, so then his decision to escape becomes more and more like, I have to do this because otherwise he will actually die. Because his case ends and he's convicted and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then another aspect I thought of it was like, it's not him. It's a man escaped, and every action that is shown on the screen is him escaping, and it could all be attributed to the title. But you know exactly what's going on behind the scenes and how many other people are involved in him escaping. It's not just him. You have the lookouts. You have the people that are supplying him. You have the friends that are giving him, you know, different objects that he needs to escape. And then, like, he has Jost, who he kind of has to trust. He has the neighbor who he kind of bounces ideas off of, you know?
Yeah.
So these are all, they're all different people who are rooting for him. It's like this shared suffering. Almost.
Yeah, and I think the main reason why they want him to escape is because it gives them hope. Hope is such a valuable tool in this world of prison. It's like without hope, that, you know, if nobody escapes, there's no hope for anybody. So having this one guy they can latch onto as that source of hope is great, and it also gives them something to engage with, like. At the very least, like, there's nothing else going on.
Yeah.
You know, what else is that neighbor? If he doesn't think he's going to escape because it's too risky, what else is he going to do? Just sitting there?
No, I know. Ben, you and I were at private school. This is exactly what happened. When nothing goes on, you create drama. That's how it goes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
No, you're definitely right. And hope is, like, one of the greatest motivators, you know?
Yeah.
There are other, I think there are other, a few greater ones.
Yeah.
Hope is one of the greatest ones. If all you have is this glimpse of hope of escaping,
yeah,
you're going to do anything to get to that point, even if it involves, you know, these hard decisions, whether or not I kill an innocent man or whether or not I'm risking my own life to get to that. But this guy's also very motivated, I'm assuming, Fontaine, because he has a family.
Right.
And that's only stated once in the film, but you assume that that motivation carries over throughout the rest. I also wondered, were the three people that supplied him at the beginning of the film, were those three that were they executed? Because then they found the letters, and they found that they told everyone who had a pencil was to be executed. I'm assuming those three, by the sheer fact that that's the only time we see three people in the same frame.
Oh, like the people who were walking up and down. Yeah.
That did not need any...
For sure, the guy who actually supplied him got executed. I don't know about the other two, but I would assume so.
Yeah, because they did mention that they had to execute three people. So I'm assuming it was those three.
It's probably those three.
Okay. Then. Well, I mean, that's probably an easy assumption to make, because then the pencils had to be taken away. And then Jost at the end says, what, death for a pencil or something? Like, shot for a pencil? I am interested also. I keep saying I'm interested. Why Fontaine did not give up his pencil?
That's a good question.
What was it necessary for? To keep continuing to write letters? It did not show him write any more letters after that.
Maybe he just didn't want to lose any tool that he had at his disposal.
I was thinking it could be three things. One, it could be when he was drawing the plans on the wall. Two, to disguise the chippings that he had on the door.
True, yeah.
Or three, to write letters to his family, but it doesn't show either of the three after they ask for the pencils back. Because he can't use it. If they see the writings on the wall, he's dead.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's maybe just the sheerly, he doesn't want to give up anything, because he doesn't exactly know what he needs in every scenario.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, like, would that put him at more risk than it would actually benefit him to have it? I'm not sure. But that's the decision that he made, I guess.
Yeah. Another thing is... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was thinking, like, would this escape actually work? But then I remembered it was based on a memoir. So I was like, that's the other thing. It's, like, so grounded. You can't say, well, this would never happen in real life, because there's actually a memoir that's about somebody. I don't know whether he did this exact escape plan, but I assume it was similar.
Yeah. And this is my headcanon, and I know that, like, the real canon exists because it's history, but my headcanon is, like, it's World War II, everybody's, like, kind of making these makeshift prisons to, like, the guards aren't, like, 100% on top of everything because they have so much going on, you know, nobody knows what's going on in the world, the war, what's happening with Hitler, blah, blah, blah. So that's why they let so many things slide, like, the ability for them to take off the lantern, it just comes off of his hinges, and they have free glass, like, what are they talking, like... And then, like, how much noise he made without it being him being caught. You know, the mattress springs, like, stuff like that. Stuff that isn't in prisons these days, because we've learned from mistakes, hopefully.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and it's just a weird thing to think about. Just, it might be, I mean, it is realistic because it's real. It happened. So these things that are specific to the film happened. And you have to think, like, maybe that's just how Germany does it as well. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, you've been to Europe, you know.
I do know. I've been to every country in Europe, and I know all of the rather daunting history of every country and their practices and stuff like that.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But speaking of accidents and stuff like that.
You're leading me into somewhere that I'm not sure where you're leading me.
Speaking of accidents, such as cars.
Oh, such as cars.
Sorry, I wasn't that straightforward.
That's a pretty clever lead-in to Hedman Anglin Agency. They can't get you out of prison, but they can help you if you wreck your car. And even if that's what leads you to going to prison, maybe they can help you with some insurance. So Hedman Anglin Agency, they are known for saving people money on car insurance, business insurance, home insurance, recently now life insurance.
They do life insurance.
Yeah, they do life insurance now.
How recent is that?
I think within the last couple months.
Wow.
So
I'm gonna start telling people that then.
Yeah, because life insurance is something that you have, especially when you're younger, you have to start thinking about, and especially when you start, I mean, it's really when you have a young family, that's the main time that, and it's a horrible thing to think about, but it's important because, you know, nothing in life is guaranteed. You could end up in a French prison. Mm-hmm. It's hard to predict what's going to happen, and you want your family to be taken care of in that tragic instance that hopefully never happens.
Maybe our listeners don't know what life insurance is. What is life insurance? Or maybe it's me. Maybe it's the listener.
Well, generally, life insurance is a policy that you take out that covers your family in the case that the primary breadwinner of the family is either maybe disabled to the point where they can't take care of the family, or tragically lose their life, or in many instances of tragedy beyond just that. And that might be just like a basic explanation.
Interesting. But I have a question. So
yeah,
if I had a daughter in wedlock that is going to get married to a guy, should I make sure he gets life insurance before she marries him?
It would probably be a good conversation to have.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'll go talk to him later.
I think the more people that are added into the family, the more it becomes a potentially a more and more important thing.
Let me give you a little history of the Leewald family. So my mom, when she was about to marry my dad, my papa, which is my mom's dad, went to my dad and said, "You cannot marry my daughter unless you get life insurance."
Interesting.
I'm glad she did. My father's alive, but my father does not regret doing it. I'm sure he was very annoyed at the time because he worked at Chuck E. Cheese as the mascot.
And he was like, "I don't have money for this policy."
Yeah. So enough tickets didn't pay for that. So it was more of a, this is what you're going to do if you want to date my daughter. There were other expectations too, or marry my daughter, but there were other expectations. So
yeah, of course.
But anyway, go buy life insurance. And if you are a father, a future father-in-law to a son that doesn't have life insurance, you should go talk to him.
Yeah.
Or not. It really doesn't matter. It's up to your discretion. But you should still go get life insurance from Hedman Anglin Agency.
Hedman Anglin Agency specifically. And so if you want to call them at 614-486-7300. That's 614-486-7300. And tell them that Ben and Zach sent you, because they'll be very happy that we're finally paying off for them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, finally somebody.
one day. But that's great. They're doing life investment. Insurance. So now it's car, business, home, life.
Car, business, home, life.
Wow, they could make like a cool graphic with that.
Yeah, and there might be some other things mixed in there, like renter's insurance, you can add on to your policy.
Is it illegal for us to make a jingle for them?
I think they'd be fine if we made them a jingle.
Car, business, home, and life. Hedman Anglin Agency, buy us or strive, or you'll have strife.
Yep. So that's trademarked now by Hedman Anglin Agency, written and directed by Zach Leewald.
Yeah.
So hopefully you don't end up in a French prison, but if you do, you should have life insurance. That's the main takeaway. And maybe you wrecked your car and that led you to being in French prison, so then you also need that.
Wait.
And you set someone's home on... Well, that wouldn't be your house insurance. Okay. Yeah. Do you want to talk about Robert?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was thinking of another jingle, but we can move on.
We can move on. Well, if you come up with it, just sing it next episode.
Okay, fair enough.
So, do you want to talk about Robert Bresson?
Yeah, Bresson is a really, really influential director.
You know what his nickname is?
What?
The patron saint of cinema.
That is... Wow. Was that made by a Catholic?
Yes.
Probably.
Because apparently he has a lot of strong Catholic themes, which probably isn't too surprising since he's from France.
Yeah.
Modern France, old France.
Oh, old France. Sorry. Yeah. I forgot you're the European. Yeah.
Catholicism and religion is sort of an old person thing in France.
Ben's our European rep over here.
This is what I got from one conversation with a girl from France who had not heard of Jean-Luc Godard. I was very disappointed. First person I met from France in England... And I was in London, so you meet people from all over Europe and stuff. I was like, "Oh, that's great! I love watching French films." And she was like, "Oh, that's." I think she was kind of surprised. Mm. Probably don't get too many.
What was
Americans.
Her hair color?
It was maybe dirty blonde.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. Continue.
And I was like, "I love French films. Do you like the French New Wave?" And she looked at me like I was crazy. And I was like, "You know, like Jean-Luc Godard."
And she's like, "What?"
She was like, "What? Well, I don't really watch that." I was like. Really?
What did she watch? TikTok?
I was like, I don't know. I didn't really get into what she watched, but I was like, you got to watch The French New Wave. Amazing, amazing cinema. The French New Wave was after Robert Bresson, so I don't, and it's fairly different from what Robert Bresson did.
Yeah.
But it's distinctly French, and so I was a little disappointed that the France people, the French people that I met had, or the one French person I met,
the dirty blonde,
had not heard of him. That was a little disappointing. She was also the one who explained that like religion was for old people in France, and they don't really think too much about religion there.
Gotcha.
I know a lot of stereotypes about France. I don't know how much of it's true, but
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have stereotypes too. They were asking you, why do you guys have guns?
Yeah. And Americans are very loud and boisterous and annoying tourists. And there's a lot of probably truth to that, but that's sort of the reputations Americans have. And also that we're kind of egotistical about our country.
I mean,
all of that's probably fairly true.
Yeah, there's some truth to every joke. Robert Bresson started out his career with writing instead of directing. He wrote He Was a Musician. That's the English title. He went into public affairs where he was actually the director as well, but that was a short film. He went to the Brighton Twins, Southern Mall, and Foolish Virgin, where he was a writer on those and then assistant director on the latter. And then his first one where he wrote and directed it was Angels of Sin. That fits with his title of the patron saint of cinema. And The Ladies of the Bois de Boulogne. I don't know how to say that. Diary of a Country Priest, A Man Escaped.
Which he compared to this movie, A Man Escaped, that he said he wanted this movie to be more pure than that movie.
Then so I'm Diary assuming of a Country Priest,
that Diary of a Country Priest was pretty stripped back, ascetic, whatever the word is.
Okay.
And then he was like, I want A Man Escaped to be even more so than that movie.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think I read that as well. But The Pickpocket was next, and that's probably one of his most well-known. Man Escaped is probably might be his most well-known, maybe.
It's Benny Safdie's favorite.
Oh, it is? Yeah.
Well, I read also that it's not only is it Benny Safdie's one of his favorite films, it's actually his favorite film. So where I'm amending what I formally said earlier.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Trial of Joan of Arc, Balthazar at Random, Gentlewoman, Four Nights of a Dreamer, Lancelot in the Lake, Devil Probably Money. And that was his last one in 1983 before probably passing away. Yes, definitely passing away. So in 1999, he died at age 98. He did not go into his 90s writing and directing films like the current Scorsese is. And yes, we just mentioned Scorsese, so we lost the bet that we
made. There's another name that I will not mention. Yeah, who's probably not influenced by
Robert Bresson. We're not going to mention the QT.
Yeah.
The cutie. But yeah, Robert Bresson, he has such a great filmography, and it really goes back to like these films that he's made, particular a few of them, you know, like Pickpocket and A Man Escaped, etc.
I feel like I hear about The Trial of Joan of Arc, although it's possible that there's other movies about Joan of Arc that I am mixing it up with, but that's another one I think I hear about.
Yeah, for sure. And he ended up winning the jury special prize for that film, and he won best director, like you said, at 1957 for The Man Escaped.
Never won the Palme d'Or for any of his movies, it doesn't look like.
No.
But he was nominated five times.
Yeah, he was nominated
four times.
And yeah, he won best director also for L'Argent, is that how you say it? And then Mouchette.
That sounds Mouchette. Musha? It's probably like Musha?
It's so bad. I'm so bad. I'm sorry. And he got, the OCIC award and whatever special distinction means. I'm not really familiar with
Never won an Academy Award, so I don't know how highly we can regard him.
Yeah. He never won an Oscar. So, but this guy, honestly, he was born in 1901. For the early 1900s, I say mid-1900s, actually, he is the guy that is in the, like, he is the French filmmaker of that time. And that really goes to show of how influential his films have been. We've already touched on many of his films. But another, like any Prison Break movie that you've seen, the elements are here. You have the makeshift items. You know, you have the gossip, the making sure that you're under the radar of the guards. The
tapping.
Yeah, definitely like the Morse code-like type of things. And then like even like just, the makeshifting is a big part of it. And so many films, genres, TV, movies, everything. There are these things that someone needs to escape in secret, and this was like the start of it. And it's crazy that it's not even like that. It's this guy's imagination. It's like this happened in real life, and that's what these movies are based off of. Like The Shawshank Redemption was influenced by Robert, who was also influenced by the whatever that guy's name, Andre. And it's just so crazy. Like this is all based in like a story that actually happened. I think that's great.
Yeah.
I wish like Star Trek and everything else, like Star Wars, was based in reality, but that's obviously not true.
It's based on Seven Samurai. Well, actually, I'm not sure about that.
But no, it's probably based on Yojimbo.
Yeah. Everything's based on Seven Samurai.
Which is based on Yojimbo.
Other than this movie.
But Seven Samurai is based on Yojimbo, so it all goes back to that, and I haven't seen it yet. I need to watch it.
Yeah.
But Seven Samurai is my second favorite.
Yeah. That's true. It is so fascinating that nobody can really claim to be more influential on Prison Break movies than this guy, because he went back to the actual source, an actual Prison Break that happened. So maybe if you want to start something that's super influential, make a very pure, dedicated piece to something that actually happened and is documented, and then go off that. And he doesn't. It's not a biopic. It's not like a you know that one movie that Angelina Jolie maybe produced. I don't think she directed. That was about Louis Zamperini and his escape from the Japanese prison camp, or his like time in the Japanese prison camp. See, that's it. That's I don't think it was rated too highly. It was an all right movie, but it's like it has all the classic like emotional elements, which is great. It is horrible. The Japanese prison camp was horrible. It shows some of that, and so that brings some like somberness to the movie. I certainly think that's respectable, but I think it maybe loses its sense of reality, because you know that it didn't go quite like that probably. For Louis Zamperini, and I think maybe it would be beneficial for some directors to be like, I want to make something that's pure again. How when's the last time we had something that was pure as this? This is like Breaking Bad, the purest level of meth, but film.
The 98%.
Yeah, blue. It's the 98%. This is the blue meth of cinema.
No, I think you're right. This is such an Ohio thing to say no and then say
no. Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah. No, no, no. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, no.
Yeah. So we're from Ohio. Right? Location reveal, but yeah, Bresson really does focus on that, and he says he has two different types of things in films when it comes to actors. So he has actors, which are he's moving from the interior, which is like the person, to the exterior, but in this film he has human models. Imagine being called a human model. That would sound so degrading, but it really is what he's doing. Movement from the exterior to the interior, where it really is the situational thing that's occurring. And he uses objects as like an action rather than going into the character himself. And honestly, that's probably because to stay authentic, you really can't assume what Andre is thinking in his memoir. You really can't assume what his thoughts are if it's not stated on the paper, right? So you kind of have to go from what he actually did. What is the history? Where do I work from? What are the facts? He's almost a science-like type of guy using human models, which is, it's a very degrading term, but that's what he used. Like, human models, come hither. Let's go and do the next scene, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
It's in Bresson, you can see the passion in his work. It's such a great film. It really takes a style that is distinct from other films. And to do something as bold as this, and so limited in music and score and plot, honestly, to do something as contained as this takes a bold director, and Bresson was that guy.
And I think I'm just gonna take a second to read through the people that Bresson influenced and what he helped develop. So I'll start with François Truffaut, who directed The 500 Blows, which was the start of the French New Wave. Truffaut was very important in developing auteur theory, which is something that Zach and I don't know whether Zach you've consciously thought about this, but we certainly subscribe to this idea of auteur theory, that a director is very, very important in the direction of a movie and can kind of make or break whether that movie works, at least in a lot of the movies that we watch. There's certain movies that are not, like maybe a Marvel movie would be a good example of the director having maybe a 50% impact of the movie and then the studio having the other 50%. Then there's ones where the studio has like 75% impact and the director changes. Has 25%. But in Truffaut had this idea of auteur theory. The director should be the one who is the life force of the movie, and everything flows through them, and they should be, and in some ways they should be credited for that, although I'm not sure that was his main concern. But Truffaut listed Bresson as somebody as among the few directors to whom the term auteur could actually be ascribed to. So, like, Bresson...
Oh, for sure. I agree.
...had every moment of the movie could be credited to Brisson. And it's also because he literally picked people who were not actors to act. So, I mean, sure, the coaches, I'm sure, helped some. But, like, he's taking these human models, like you said, and he's making it into a film. And you honestly can't even see. So you can't say, like, oh, wow, Brad Pitt was so amazing in this. And you know, all the work that Brad Pitt put into it. It's strictly Brisson's ability to make this a cohesive thing that makes it a great movie. And so Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard, who is hugely important in the French New Wave as well, especially with Breathless. So they took that and they made it into their own thing in the 60s when they made movies about French people who were just like walking around cities and doing stuff. And it was great for the time. And that influenced the new wave of Hollywood, which included Martin Scorsese and other people who took it in different directions. Zach is mad at me.
Yeah, careful.
And Brian De Palma and people like that. Other filmmakers, Andrei Tarkovsky, Abel Ferrara, Hal Hartley.
Oh, yes.
From okay. Henry Fool.
I feel
influenced.
That.
Jim Jarmusch.
I feel that. Jim's in there.
Oh, Louis yes. Malle. Mikhail Haneke.
Hold on, Ben. Pause. I actually, when I watched this film, I thought of Jim Jarmusch because I was like, it's such a contained story with characters in a setting that really does come out.
Yeah. I really think you can extend. Jim Jarmusch added a bit more thematicism maybe to his movies. Okay. But especially his first movie, you could say is almost a direct, other than the fact that it's not so focused on a singular task.
I'd say Stranger Than Paradise is more relates to Man Escaped than Mystery Train. Those are the only ones I've seen.
Yeah. And I'm sure the black and white element and helps a lot.
I mean, kind of, but I'm saying the story.
It has more of a lack of direction, or obvious direction, than A Man Escape, but
yeah.
You can definitely see the influence. Michelle Haneke, who I've seen one of his movies, and I would agree that it was fairly similar to that. Some other and Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver and co-wrote Raging Bull and has directed several movies.
Oh man, so many. He's one of the greatest writers. Yeah,
including First Reformed. And he actually wrote a book called Transcendental Style in Film, Ozu, Brisson, Dreyer, where he had a critical analysis of Robert Brisson. Ingmar Bergman, the great Swedish director, praised, and he was directing movies around the same time that Brisson was. I think like The Seventh Seal, which is the only Bergman movie I've seen, was like the year after this movie. But he had been making films for a while, and he thought that Brisson was very good. Jean Cocteau, Jean-Pierre Melville, Krzysztof Kieślowski. It feels like anybody notable, Wes Anderson, Christopher Nolan, anybody who's anybody. Werner Herzog, Werner Herzog, I should say.
As much as I hate to say it, I'd put Greta Gerwig in there right now.
Greta Gerwig probably. And some people, it's like they're probably if they're not influenced by Brisson, they're influenced by somebody who was influenced by Brisson.
Yeah, it all goes back, like I said.
Yeah. So it's, and I think Brisson, because of how tedious his films are, they aren't beloved in the sense that people go back and like rewatch them a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe his name doesn't have the staying power that somebody like Godard does. But without Brisson, you know, it's hard to say where French cinema would be. I mean, he may not be inseparable from what happened later, but he was certainly an important piece that influenced a lot of people in the future.
It was certainly a commentary on the war that had just happened. But on that, I have two abstract thoughts. So the first one is, André, in his time in prison, in a French prison, do you think he would have ever, and this is, the answer is no, but I'm thinking like, I would never imagine if an angel were to come down in my prison cell and tell me, hey, this experience, keep writing in your journal because you're going to influence French cinema and even American cinema for years and decades to come. And I would be so confused. Like, how does my imprisonment have anything to do with anything else? And like, people are going to make billions of dollars off your memoir. Just imagine.
It is remarkable how the chain reaction of events that causes things to happen and how they often start from very humble. So, I mean, I would consider that a significant thing that happened, but not something that you would imagine would directly influence entertainment.
And you could say the same thing to Anne Frank. But my second thought was, I'd say people like Brisson have kind of carved out their own corner where it's the director's control is happening. And those are the directors that are famous. Those are the lists that you made, including QT. But you have this shift of like these Hollywood stars, you know, even at this time you had big stars and you had that carry on until, you know, the 80s and 90s, these huge stars, even into the early 2000s. And then you get into these corporate IP types of things where it's more of these movie stars are dying. It's more of these bigger Captain America-like projects where it's no longer the names. It's the titles of the movies.
Studios.
Yeah.
Franchise theory.
But what has persisted is the Bersonians, right? The people who have carved out their own corner that are unaffected by the shift, the cultural shift in the movies, the movie world. Where they can't be affected because their direction is so clear and so vivid and so pure, like in this film, that it can't be snuffed out by any IP at all because they have people who support them and people like us who like to kind of think about them in that way. So if we have these, you know, quote unquote lowercase gods of the cinema world, the patron saint of cinema, continue on, then I feel like there is hope for cinema. In this dark, dark time. Even after Oppenheimer and Barbie, which were great. They were fun. They were really fun. Both of them.
And Oppenheimer was the result of a similar film, Memento, which was more a humble version of what was to come. So you can see how humble.
Oppenheimer really... Like, Nolan's, like, strutting his stuff when he films it in 70mm IMAX. So.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of
so
like...
So everything starts small and builds, but things have to go back to being small, too.
Yeah.
In order for you to have great films that are massive in scale.
And I really appreciate the people who are humble. Like, honestly, like Jim Jarmusch and Bressant. Like, Bressant probably died not as rich as Christopher Nolan, you know?
Yeah, probably.
And that's okay. Not even close. I appreciate that they stick to their craft and they love it. And they have this little corner of the cinema world. And they keep it alive for people who actually appreciate movies for what movies are and deeper meanings rather than these cameo filled festivals, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's just not a rat on today's film world, but with the writer's strike going on, it's really bleak. So,
yeah.
This might be the last breath of fresh air with Oppenheimer and Barbie that we have before the wave of nothing for a little bit.
And you got to hope that during that wave of nothing, there are independent films that rise up and capture the public attention, and perhaps it will end up being a good thing, although I don't know how affected even those are by the writer's strike and the actor strike, but because certainly independent movies, I keep using that word, sometimes they'll grab a major actor so they have a name tied to it and things like that. But hopefully there's something that can fill the void that will be a positive thing.
Something will fill the void, whether it's great, good or not. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just hope it's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Because
TikTok could fill the void.
No, that's the worst case scenario, really. If Lil Huddy becomes a movie star, that's the worst case. If Charlie becomes...
TikTok movies?
No.
Go into theaters?
No, gosh.
Or like, it's just
their
like...
Their portrait.
We go to the theater to watch curated... like, it's just like curated, you watch TikToks.
And no. They have a theater where it's a vertical screen. And it's just like for teenagers who are addicted to TikTok to come in and watch these short clips of film. I mean, honestly, that's experimental. I would watch a little bit, but I would probably get sick of it and think it's stupid.
It would be cool if you could make a movie that it was like all on TikTok. Like there was a storyline through every single...
No, it would not be cool. It would stress me out.
It would be really stressful.
It would stress me out. But with that, I think that's great. Bressant, thank you so much. I know you're dead, but thank you. For that.
If I was Catholic, I would say a little prayer, but I'm not.
Yep, we're not.
So I don't believe it. I don't believe in that. Do not believe in praying to saints.
No. But thanks for throwing that in there for sure. Yeah, but no, yeah, it's been a great ride, and I'm glad we've gone on this track right now with Mystery Train to now A Man Escaped. And what's next for us?
So I believe we're watching it tonight, then we'll record a review at some point. Inland Empire. Then we'll follow that up with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Which is a switch into
that it is not that important that we watch the first Star Trek. So we will be only... I don't know why they call it Star Trek II. I think it's the movies are still kind of episodic, kind of like the TV show. Okay. There might be a few TV show episodes that are helpful in the background, but my brother, who's going to be a guest on that one, said they may not be that necessary to watch. So we might just go into it with a blank canvas and see what Star Trek's all about. I've seen like one or two Star Trek episodes in my life, so I know very little.
Yep, and then we have a couple other ones on the radar as well. And stay tuned for the 100th episode, which we'll reveal probably after the 99th. So. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about, let's each say a little bit about three movies we've watched in the last 3 months.
I'll give a bad review for Mamma Mia. I just watched that this past week. It was fun. It was just not for me. I really don't appreciate musicals that are kind of over the top. I was really confused why Meryl Streep was the lead. I was so confused why she picked a project like this. But then at the end, apparently she doesn't do sequels. So, like, she wasn't in the... Maybe she's in the
They're making a third one.
They are?
Yeah. Okay. No, wait, they aren't. That's My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
I think they've already made a Mamma Mia 3.
They probably have made a third one.
So, it was fun. It's just not for me. I saw A Man Called Otto. It was fine. I've heard that it's based off of a film that's much better, so I didn't think that it would. I mean, it probably didn't live up to the hype according to people who I trust, but it was, you know, it was fine. I always love Tom Hanks, and a grumpy Tom Hanks is fine. Yeah, and you know, the suicide stuff, it was weird because it was kind of brushed by quickly. For me, that was a little interesting, but it was still fun. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Earlier this year, I watched Nope. That was great. I liked it. Yeah. Nope, I did. I really like the Jordan Peele series that he's done. I don't know why.
I've never seen a Jordan Peele movie. That's one of my biggest holes.
He has his own style. He's not a Bressonian yet, but his own style is kind of getting into these films. The only thing, it's very African American black based, so it's kind of like a very niche genre, and it's really come up in you know, it really has come up as like this great African-American movie type of things.
Yeah,
and they are great films. I think that they are, but I'd say his best is Get Out, and then Us, and then Nope. Those are his three. He kind of had a role to play in Candyman, but it's not directed by him. But
yeah, I think he's also subsuming this role as kind of one of the curators of horror in general, so that's probably kind of his Candyman.
I think it's more of a response to the lack of great horror movies in the last, you know, 10-20 years.
Yeah.
So he's kind of trying to go back to that. And he gives an interesting twist. It's almost sci-fi, horror, character-based films that are really good. But I really like Nope. It was great. Aliens. I love Steven Yeun. He's great. The Walking Dead. So I hope that he's in other films like that. But yeah, thank you, Jordan Peele. I haven't heard any announcements for a new Jordan Peele movie. I hope there's another one.
I'm sure
I hope it's less horror. I hope he goes into other genres.
Yeah, that would be interesting if he did.
Because he's done three now. So yeah. What about you? What are your three?
So I was going to give one from each month. I watched The Whale on the plane back from England, and it was everything I could have asked for in a movie like The Whale. I had sort of...
What do you ask for? Really big people and Sadie sink?
Yeah, it had some... It was a fairly... I've seen Darren Aronofsky movies, so it didn't quite shock me, like the direction that it went, because... Most of his movies are about people who are like obsessed and have major issues in their life because of their obsession. Now, Black Swan and Requiem for a Dream are a bit more surreal. This movie was more of a straightforward like story. The way it was filmed, I can't even put my finger on it. The way it looked was kind of interesting. And I guess it did get a little bit more maybe surreal towards the end of the movie.
What is the scene that you think of when you think of that movie?
That scene where he like eats, he like puts ranch dressing on the pizza and just like shoves everything together.
Interesting.
Like, but I also think of him just like sitting in his chair and talking to people and crying, and I don't know. It's a tough movie to watch. It got criticized. I could understand where people are coming from with some of the criticism, but I thought it was a fairly decent movie. Probably not the best Darren Aronofsky movie. I was a pretty big fan of Black Swan when I first watched it. I think I did rate it 5 stars on Letterboxd. So I'm sort of more of an Aronofsky fan.
You were raving about Black Swan for a while.
Yeah. But I don't know whether now I might have to revisit my opinion on Black Swan. But that's for another day to do that.
From that, I've learned that I need to watch Black Swan. Because I've seen The Whale and I love The Whale.
I definitely appreciate The Whale. Gave it like 3.5 stars. Then I watched Wes Anderson's first movie, Bottle Rocket.
Oh,
good. Which was a very fun movie. Again, rate it 3.5 stars. Very fun. It's not quite, it's obviously the beginning. Uh-huh. Yeah. It has a lot of quirks like every Wes Anderson movie does,
but it's not, his style isn't defined.
It's not defined.
Yeah.
It's not the Grand Budapest Hotel where he has all the miniatures and everything.
That's my,
but there's still the hijinks is there. The camaraderie. I love the Wilson brothers in it. Mm-hmm. Owen and Luke, great chemistry together.
And were you the one who told me that they were roommates? Owen and, Anderson, or was it someone? Was it Luke?
I don't think I told you that. I didn't know that they were.
I think
roommates.
Luke and Anderson were roommates in college.
That's amazing.
Or it might have been Owen.
I think Luke Anderson, he definitely hasn't had as good of a career as Owen Wilson has. And Owen Wilson obviously has the classic voice, which, that's just like perfect. But
what is the voice?
Ka-chow. Like, I don't, that's wow. Not even that good.
Wow.
But he's such a great actor. He's perfect.
He's awesome. Loki season 2 trailer came out today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's why I sent you earlier.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you gotta watch
it. I wish Luke Wilson was in more stuff, because I think he's very talented as well. I like the movie a lot. It was very fun, and it's like maybe not Wes Anderson's best, but it's just like good to see where it all started.
Yeah. But wait, and before you move on, I actually had my ranking. I haven't told you for what best Wes Anderson film has changed.
Really?
To Rushmore.
Rushmore. I do love Rushmore. Rushmore is very good.
I think it's the best.
I think my least favorite is Life Aquatic. I don't know if you've seen that one.
I haven't seen that.
It's my least. Well, I can't say that with 100% assurance, because I have to look back. But yeah,
your Letterboxd rating is inconsistent with your current notion.
Probably. That's very likely in a lot of cases.
Okay.
Because some of them are like,
no, we all 2 years old. We're good. Rating.
Yeah. Same and then finally, American Graffiti, which I went into not knowing a whole lot about, but it's George Lucas, his first directed film. Maybe not his first, but one of the earlier ones. Has Harrison Ford in it. He's not a main role. Has Ron Howard from Happy Days. Eventually would transition to be more of a director. But Ron Howard as a teenager coming off Happy Days. Goes for that Happy Days vibe. A little bit more edgy. More about Happy Days was kind of like a clean cut family show. American Graffiti a little bit more like, well, teens drink and they race cars and that sort of thing. But it definitely reminded me of Dazed and Confused. Of course, Dazed and Confused came out in the 90s, so it was probably influenced by American Graffiti, but it was about the 50s instead of the 70s. Mm-hmm. Days and Confused about the
Harrison
70s.
Ford's in this?
Harrison Ford is in this.
Yeah.
Like I said, more of
Luke is his favorite, I'm guessing.
Yeah, more of a side character in this movie, but still a notable character.
I bet he saw that he could carry a scene.
Yeah, probably. I think the best thing about this movie was it all happens in one night, and the thing that interlinks every scene in the movie is a radio station. And so there'll be like one group of kids, they're driving around in a car, songs will be playing on the radio, and then in order to switch the scene, the song will continue playing, and then they go to the next car, and then that radio station is still playing in that car. So it just feels very fluid, and it goes seamlessly between character to character in that way, and then it ends like early in the morning. And it's sort of like in between high school and college kind of summer, which I can relate to having that summer not too long ago, and it being like really fun summer where it felt like there weren't a lot of responsibilities.
But no, that's when we started this podcast.
Yeah, and it was when we started this podcast. There's not as many responsibilities, but you have this looming sense that your life is going to change. And that's kind of, this is like literally the day before they're leaving for college. It's like the last night that they have all together. So it's very, I thought it was very good. Give it 4 out of 5. Nothing like Star Wars. That's the interesting thing. Not at all like Star Wars, but
it's interesting because the Star Wars transitions also stick out to me. So it's interesting. Like he's probably known for that. Then it's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
what about our socials?
Our socials: themovievaultpod@gmail.com is our email. Instagram @themovievaultpod. Twitter @movievaultpod.
Yeah.
We're most active on Instagram, so follow that first.
And stay tuned for David Lynch's, right?
Inland Empire.
Yeah, yep. It's a 3-hour movie. Here we go, Ben. Yep. We're about to watch it right after this. So.
Yep.
Let's order food and get the drinks.
And watch Robert Bresson.
Yeah, do that. Close the vault.
Oh, yeah, we do have to close it.